Clancy from Los Angeles.
My name is Clancy Imslund. I'm an alcoholic. You always feel a little odd when the newcomer with 5 days sober looks healthier than the guy with 46 years. For Christ's sake, get a black eye or something. But I'm glad to be here tonight. I want to just say something. I didn't want to say it, but God has asked me to say it, and Bill Wilson. In the mid-1960s, out in the San Fernando Valley, there was an old guy named Bill Davidson. And he was kind of a crazy old guy, and he had strong opinions. One of them was that everyone in AA should be anonymous, not from the public, but from each other. You know, just. And when they would read the traditions, he would whisper along with them. He would say, "Principles before personalities." You hear that? They'd say, "Shut up, Bill. Not going to shut up." And this went on for a little while. And three or four young guys I knew about, because I sponsored one of them, began mocking Bill, and they would say, "Principles before personality, is that right, Bill?" He's, "Shut up, not going to shut up." And this went on for a little while, and then a guy from the Sylvan Cedros group came over one night and spoke and heard this and thought it was some new spiritual facet of AA and took it back to the, and they began saying, "Principles before personalities." They never knew why, they just said it. And for about 20 years in the mid-San Fernando Valley, there's four groups or so, we used to call them the Chanters. We would say, "Principles before personalities." "Why do you say that?" "I don't know. That's what we do here." Yeah. And that was all right. Good kind of a joke. You people behind the post, you don't know what you're missing. I had a great looking tie on. But I'm about 6'4" and I got blonde curly hair. But anyway, somehow the cork got out of the bottle. And pretty soon you heard in Burbank somebody saying, "Principles before personalities." "Why are you saying that?" "I don't know." And little by little, now there's several places you hear it, a lot of places. And the irony of it all, where it started, part of their format is to say specifically, "Please do not chant." But I mean, if you're new tonight, I want to tell you that you're seeing a phenomenon. Because now they do it at the end of chapter 5. They did it after that, chapter 5. "God, good room, salt." Probably would do it after the promises, too, if they knew what they were. But I have no objection to your chanting. If you want to chant, that's fine. It has nothing to do with AA. It is done nowhere else in the world. But if you'd like to do that. But I'm just talking to the new people, the people who were standing up recently. If you've been here a long time, 6 months or so, you're probably so set in your ways, there's no way to get to you. But you're in your first few weeks. You don't have to chant. Has nothing to do with AA, means nothing. All you're doing is mocking Bill Davidson in the San Fernando Valley, and he's been dead since 1971. All right. That's the end of that. Yeah, it worked. But I know you've had a good day today. I've got a good report on it. I wanted to get out here, and I had to work a little later than I thought I did. And then the traffic coming out of L.A. was really bad this afternoon for some reason. I want to especially get out and hear Sherry Ann talk on the steps. And I know she's up to 2 now, and I guess she could have winged it after that. But she's... I'm going to get a set of these tapes from our taper, and I do a lot of traveling on the freeway, and I'll listen to them one by one as I travel along, and if I find any errors, I'll call up the speaker and tell them. But we do have a lot of new people here today. For some reason, I was sitting there thinking about the new people, and I empathize with them a little bit, because I was new off and on for a long time. And it's kind of hard. They say, you know, you're home now, you're not so different. And it's very hard to accept that because you look around, you are different. You look different, you feel different. There's all kinds of people here, sizes, shapes, and colors, and religions, and everybody got a different drinking story to one degree or another. And there's really, you wonder, what the hell do I have in common with these people? Because you talk to somebody, they haven't done what you've done, and you haven't done what they've done, and what do we have in common? And that always was a puzzlement to me. I had a great deal of difficulty in identifying an AA, and I came to AA as a young man... came today as a young man, and I didn't feel like it applied to me. The first three steps of AA always turned me off. I thought they turned me off completely, because my problem isn't really alcohol, and I can't return to God, and so I'm not going to turn my life over to God. That doesn't work. Some of the other steps look pretty good, but those three are rotten. And I, after I was sober this time for a while, I must have heard Chapter 3 read 50 times over the years. I'm not sending any more child support. Oh. I thought she was coming this way. You never can tell when you get out around Riverside what's going to happen next. I do want to say something that reminds me of something. You know, I've been coming out to Riverside for 40 years. When I first came out here, I was a young, sharp guy. I'm getting a little old and feeble down, weak. And I was telling somebody before the meeting, you know, I now go into Hollywood singles bars and go up to pretty young girls and say, "Hi there, do I come here often?" Some years ago, when I turned 70, my doctor started giving me iron tablets, which I guess is for your blood. I don't know what it's for, but something. And I've been taking these iron tablets for a lot of years. And then a few months ago, and I don't want to give the wrong, don't want to tell you why this happened, but something stimulated me. I tried a Viagra. And I didn't know that if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now every 6 hours I face north. I'm sorry. All of that started because that girl got up with a baby. Don't do that again. Anyway. I must have heard Chapter 3 read several times, many times over the years, and I read it a few times, and I read the book, and I remember there's just some more of the stuff in the book, kind of dull. And I went on a sober while, and the young man that I just gave the book to, I told him something that'll sound strange, I suppose, but I told him, "This isn't going to make sense for a while. Just have confidence. It will sooner or later. It gets smarter every year. But at first, it's dumb." And it was dumb to me at first. But that Chapter 3, really, in a real sense, tells you, if you're new, some things that you have in common with us, not at a superficial level, but at a real deeper level. What are the things they talk about? Let me say one more thing. Let me qualify one more thing. There seems to be types of alcoholics. Nobody ever knows what they are. I mean, they've never been described much, but there seems to be a type of alcoholic who, by any measurement, is an alcoholic, and something happens severely stringent to threaten his security, and he or hers, and maybe lose a job or lose a family or death in the family or something, and they quit, and they never drink again. And we all know of cases like that. We hear of those cases. There's another group of people who have become physically addicted to alcohol as well as psychologically addicted, and these are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created to medically withdraw these people, because it really is alcoholic addiction is a lethal, fatal thing. You've got to be medically withdrawn. And each step of the way, they point out the nature of their problem, and they quit, and they never drink again. There's a hospital up in Seattle specializes in these kind of people called the Schick Shadel Hospital. And they talk about in 30 days they can cure your alcoholism, and they do. They got a long list of people they've helped. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any measurement, and they something stringent happens to threaten their security. They lose a family or a job or somebody's death or something, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these same people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, and they mean it. And they say, "I quit, no more." And they always eventually drink again. And these are the people who've always been just a bafflement to everyone who tried to help them. They have records of 5,000 years of this type of alcoholic, and people, at one time they thought they were possessed by devils. They put them to death, and they flogged them and sent them away and all sorts of things. And they're the type of people who fills rooms like this. Now, we don't get flogged so much, and we don't get killed so much anymore, but we've all, most of us have had the experience of seeing in the face of someone who loves us that terrible look of disappointment again. Oh, how could you? You were doing so well. And you were really, and the kids were doing better, and you got your job back, and now look at you, you're drunk again. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And when that happens, and you, if you're like me, you get that feeling, you just, I feel as bad as they do, and I can't explain it either, so I just say, shut up and leave me alone, because I don't know what to say. It's a terrible thing. And they think I don't care, and I don't know how to explain to them that I care so much I can't stand it. But this type of alcoholic, these are the people who gather in these rooms, as I say. When Bill Wilson wrote this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, he didn't know a great deal about the kinds of alcoholics. But he talks about alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type are people who don't stay sober, no matter what you do. And that's what's so baffling about it. And in chapter 3, it talks a little bit about what these alcoholics are like. All of us seems to, alcoholics of our type, seem to, somewhere along the line, have voluntarily or involuntarily accepted the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And it says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursued in the gates of insanity and death. And it talks about none of us wish to admit we're different. And we, although deep in our hearts, we know we're more different than anybody. And we have occasional brief recoveries. We've all had those. It's getting better now, followed always by still worse relapse. We've all had those. If they wouldn't, we wouldn't be here. And we keep drinking and fighting it. And you get to that, what a delicious little crisp phrase, do you reach a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Remember when I first read that, I thought, that's how drunk you get. But that isn't what that is at all. That's how you feel after you get sober again, after having been drunk again. And they want some answers from me for my behavior, and I haven't got any answers for them. And then they talk, that funny little paragraph in there, that what people like us do. Change from one kind of booze to another. And there they say scotch to brandy. It could be for anything. Change from one to another. Or another one, drinking beer only. God, most of us have tried that. I've tried that again and again. Never drinking at home. Always drinking at home, so I'm not in trouble out in that street. Drinking wine only. Reading inspirational literature. Taking a physical exercise. Taking trips. Doing something different. And people around us are just baffled by this. What the hell are you doing all that for? But that stuff is killing you. And they don't understand it. And I'll tell you, I don't, and we don't understand it either. And it's a very frightening and baffling thing. Now this, these are some of the things that make us similar. That we all go through that sort of thing. Different patterns, different stories, but the patterns are there. Continuing to drink after it's apparent we shouldn't drink and can't drink. And why would anybody do that? And there's nobody, never ever seemed to have much of an answer. And that's why that it... That's little clan scenes. No, the check's in the mail, honey. But that's why people like us are living straight. And we all have different backgrounds and different histories. And I had my first drink. Never thought much. I mean, I thought it was a big, significant thing. Some people can't remember the first drink. But when I was a kid, I grew up in a very strict place up in northern Wisconsin, Norwegian Lutheran town. And you've never heard much about the Norwegian Lutherans around here. Because they don't. Let me tell you about the Norwegian Lutherans. A few years ago, I was talking at a convention in Oslo. And afterwards, the convention, they took me up north of there to where my grandfather and his brothers had come from in the 1880s. And a big migration came from Norway to America in the 1880s to get out of that damn climate. Then they came here, and they all settled in North Dakota and Wisconsin and Minnesota. And spent the rest of their life saying, Jesus is cold here too. Yeah. That's the kind of head I face every morning when I get up. When I grew up in a I didn't know it was a strict church. It was just what all we knew, and we were the majority. And I hear people in AA say things like, I've been searching for God for 30 years. I never searched for God 10 seconds. I've known where he was since I was 2 years old. He slowly circles the Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. And he gives it to Catholics. And that was all right with me till I became one and married the other. We don't have a purgatory in the Norwich Lutheran Church. It's just, you are screwed. But I look back at my life, you know, I had a very structured life. That should have told me something. I didn't, though. I didn't know any better. But I was shoved ahead in school a year and a half, and I could read fast. And I was always smaller than my classmates, but I was as smart as they were, and always played ball with them, did other things. And I was catechized and confirmed and was doing quite well. And when I was 12 years old, my parents got divorced. Now, that doesn't sound like much. That happens all the time. But can you believe this, to be in a situation where you're 12 years old and never have heard of a divorce? Because nobody ever got divorced. Nobody in our church, nobody in our family, nobody. I never heard anybody get divorced. If there were, they never told me about it. And all I knew is that all of a sudden everything went to hell. And something about me, the bad part of me, took over right then without any knowledge or experience. I immediately, without any training, began playing my mother against my father to avoid structure and to avoid discipline. When my mother gave me hell, I'd run to my dad. My dad gave me hell, I'd run to my mother. When they both gave me hell, I'd run to my grandma. And I outsmarted them again and again and again and again. I outwitted them. Jeez, I really fooled them. But then I was 15. I was flunking out of school. I felt bad all the time. I just seemed to have any friends much anymore. I just irritable and cross, and I'd refooled everybody. And I didn't realize until many years later, looking back, that that's what lack of structure does to people like me. And when I was 15, I was about ready to do something, to go to the reformatory or something. And what saved my life, the Second World War started. And I went to a few movies and watched John Wayne kill Japs, and that was good, and kill Germans. And I thought, that's what I can do. I don't like this town anymore. I don't like these people anymore. I'll go to the Pacific and become a Marine and kill Japs. So I told my mother I wanted to go to Superior, Wisconsin, to visit my little aunt, and she gave me a little bus fare and my little suitcase, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. Had no idea where the hell I was going. It was about this big and a face full of pimples. And guy gave me a ride to Minneapolis. I said, how do you get to San Francisco? He says, down this road somewhere. And I never hitchhiked. Car stops. He says, where are you going, kid? I said, San Francisco? Good, so am I. Hop in. Here's the Navy going back to a ship. I don't know when the hell he ever stopped. He must have been a saint. For days he listened to me blubber and talk and babble. And he bought all my meals. At night, there were no motels. It'd be trailer courts. And I never thought a thing about it. I never hitchhiked. I thought that's the way it was. You tell them where you want to go, and they take you there. I said, you know. I told him I wanted to be in the Marines and kill Japs. And he said, you're a little small, kid. You don't look, your pimples kind of give you away. He said, but they're really crying for merchant marine sailors. I mean, all the good guys have gone in the Navy. And I'll drop you off at the Coast Guard office and tell them you're 16. Don't tell them you're 15 and see what happens. So I'm in this Coast Guard office, and I was kind of thrilled. I could smell the ocean for the first time, and here's these all big buildings. And I said, I want to be in the merchant marine. Guys, here's an application, kid. Fill it out. And I filled it out, and I put down 16. He said, you're only 16, kid. Need your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. Came back. And that day they issued me Seaman's papers. I mean, they were just dying for anybody warm if they could get in. And a guy took me to the National Maritime Union down on Montgomery Street to sign a waiver for my dues, whatever the hell that meant. And then he took a couple guys over to the Embarcadero and they put us on this big ship. And that afternoon we were on our way to the South Pacific. And it was really fun for about an hour. That's Treasure Island. That's where the World's Fair was. Oh. That's Alcatraz. Ooh. That's the Golden Gate Bridge. Oh. But that's the end of it. Nothing after that. And they put me in a room. They called it a cabin, but it wasn't a cabin. If you live in Wisconsin, you know the cabin's got logs in it. This was a room with three of the worst type of people than any small, frightened, Norwegian, Lutheran, dumb, pimply-faced little puke could be with. And these people are called men. What the hell are you supposed to be? I didn't realize why they were so down on me. I realized now I was the fourth man of their four-man watch, and they realized I wasn't going to do any of it. They were going to do all of theirs. But I could see there's a tension. I told them a little joke that I was used to over Gooden Study Hall. Didn't go over there at all. Just get your bunk and shut up. I still remember feeling that ship moving. I never had that feeling. There was a ship moving around, and these guys start talking. And I couldn't believe my ears. I mean, I'd been a kind of a bad Lutheran because some days I didn't remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy, and some days I didn't honor my mother and father, and some days I said a bad word. But these guys were sinners. I mean, sinners. I mean, big time. They'd been in San Francisco running around with women for days, and I just never heard anything like that. I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with people. Yeah. And I suddenly realized, of course, they've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics I've heard about. But eventually I found a role on that ship. I became the ship fool after a few days. Hey, kid, go out of the engine room. Tell them we need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And these guys would sit around every day and drink whiskey after their end of their watch. They shouldn't have drink. Shouldn't have been allowed. But who's going to stop them? These guys were tough. Any other era, they'd have been pirates. I mean, just, you know, they could. Ha! And I watched these guys drink their whiskey. Now, to the best of my knowledge, I'd never been in the same room with a bottle of whiskey. And I was shocked. And one day, one of these guys turned to me and says, "How about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And I drew the line there, because I may be a dumb little kid, but I'm not like that. And I just decided to just demolish him. I was going to say, "All right, you, I guess you don't know that I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. We don't drink alcohol, and if we did, we wouldn't drink that stuff. I promised my mother and grandmother I'd never drink, and I feel sorry for you because you're such a bad person. You're probably a Catholic, but I'm a Lutheran, and I won't drink it. Don't ever offer that to me again." I was just going to tell him that. He says, "Well, do you think you're man enough?" And I heard this voice say, "God damn right." A little weak under pressure, too. So I had my first drink out of the first bottle of whiskey I was ever close to. It burned my mouth and my throat, my stomach and my throat and my mouth and his shirt, finally. To this day, I don't know a worse feeling than public humiliation, public embarrassment, where you just made to look like a total fool and you can't do anything about it. I'm like, you hit these guys. You know, I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. It would have thrown me overboard, but it would have been cute, you know. "All right, lean over, you." "Yeah." "Take that." Just give one of the old eye. But all the way across the Central Pacific where nobody's looking, I would sneak into one of these guys' sea bags every day and take a drink of whiskey, and I hated it. And I'd throw it up and I'd have to wipe it up. But I wanted so desperately for those guys to think I was a man. And nothing would have made them think I was a man, but I didn't know that. And we were just coming into Pearl Harbor, and God, they were still digging up the ships. And night before my 16th birthday, I was down there taking a drink of that stuff. Nobody was around. And it burned my mouth and my throat and my stomach and stayed down. Never stayed down before. And I couldn't breathe. Oh, God. And all of a sudden, something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. Now, that's why they drink that crap, you know. I never thought much about it, because in your teens you learn things, you know. It's a, other people in AA, I've heard other people who have insights along the way. I heard a guy say a few years ago, when I held that first drink down, I knew I'd gone into a new garden of experience with many flowers and fruits to be savored over the coming years until the fruits turned sour in my mouth. And I put them down and came to this wonderful program. I thought, God, I wish I'd known that. Well, I learned, if you can breathe and you don't puke, it makes you feel better. That's what I learned. And I didn't become a terrible alcoholic. The next day they took me to Honolulu and got me 3 or 4 bottles of beer, and I got drunk, and they thought it was funny, and I thought it was funny. I didn't become craving for alcohol. On that ship, I learned how to smoke. You know, nobody in my family smoked, but they all smoked, so I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. And finally didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day every day for the next 40-some years. In fact, I want to tell you something. I shouldn't get off the subject, but it's such a sad thing. These days, you go through California, and outside of every door, there's always a little crowd of poor bastards, you know. Raining on them. And I'm an old... I had to give up smoking because I took an operation on my throat some years ago, but I'm still a smoker at heart. It just hurts me. But worse than that, strangers think they have the right to come up and denounce smokers, you know. Why do you smoke? Don't you know that secondhand smoke is helping us? It's hurting us too. Aren't you ashamed? You just want to smash them. And I, they were doing that just before I had my throat surgery. And it took me a long time to think of an answer to it. By the time I thought of the answer, I couldn't smoke anymore, so I haven't had a chance to use it. But if you're a smoker tonight, I'm going to give you the greatest gift you've ever had. There isn't another AA meeting in the world where you'd get this information. But when some puke comes up to you and says, why do you smoke? Here's what you say. Why do I smoke? I have a feeling that one of these days they'll find a market for phlegm and I'll be rich. I'll guarantee you that person will never ask you again. But I went on a, came back and went on another ship to the Aleutian Islands. We were trying to get the Aleutian Islands back from the Japanese. Some of you don't know that. The Japanese had part of the Aleutian Islands in World War II. And then I went in the Navy, and I was old enough, and at the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital up outside San Francisco being sewed together, and they passed around some tests, and I wasn't good on tests. And so they gave me a high school diploma, and I went back after the war and went to the University of Wisconsin and went to school, won some trophies for the university. Met this girl with lovely black eyes and black hair just flashing mysteriously, and she won my heart, and then she dropped the big one on me. She said, I'm a Catholic. I can't take you home. What can I do with you? But she won my heart. We got married. My grandmother went into a depression for about 2 years. She got over it. And I went out in the world and I became a sports writer, which to this day is my favorite job I've ever had, writing, covering sports. But then my wife began manifesting the terrible behavior patterns of Catholics that I knew nothing of and no one had ever told me. If you're a Lutheran, you better listen to this. No matter how pretty Catholic girls are, if they are good Catholics, you are about to have a big family, Bunky. My wife began turning out children at terrible speed. Now I became a national distributor of small Catholics. I remember saying to my wife, can't we use birth control? She said, no. And I'll tell you something funny. If she had said yes, I don't know what I'd have done. It's hard for young people to realize this today, but in those days, nobody talked about that sort of thing. Kind of bad kids would have to say things like, I got a rubber. And even they would be ashamed to go in and buy them. They'd have to hire someone depraved to go in and buy them. And even they would be ashamed. They'd go and say things like, give me a package of cigarettes. And some rubbers. Now look how much progress we've made in the last 55 years or so. Rite Aid drugs over at my house. Kids come in and say, hey, I want a package of condoms. And some cigarettes. That's it. Weird, weird. Yeah. So I had to get better jobs with all these kids. I got into advertising and public relations, and I worked around in big corporations and various places. And all these years I drank and caroused and had a wonderful time. And we all blamed it on being a veteran. And the only problem I ever had is I have a tendency sometimes to drink too much. Or as I prefer to believe, as my psychiatrist told me later, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. And when I drink too much, I act bizarrely sometimes. And so when I was still a young man, somebody said to me, you know, you get wild. Why don't you go to this new thing called AA they got in town? Because even some of the town drunks are cutting down going there. So I went there, and I went to this room, and eight fat old guys sitting around a table or so, and they looked at me and said, what are you doing here? And I didn't realize that there was nobody within 20 years of me in that state who was in AA. I was 22. I didn't know. I said, well, they suggest I come here. Do you think you're an alcoholic? No, I really don't think so. I'm trying to be honest. He said, what the hell do you think's wrong with you? I think I'm too sensitive. Wrong answer. I never said that again for a long time. Like being back in that ship again, you know. But I hung around there for a while. I still went to meetings. They eventually thought I was just a dumb kid, so they didn't hold it against me that I was so dumb. And I learned what an alcoholic was. If you're new tonight, the guys who are new, you won't know what an alcoholic is. The people whose problem is alcohol, and they have a bad time with alcohol, and they get sober, come to AA, and admit their problem is alcohol, and they return to God and live pretty well after that. And I never felt an identification with that at all. Because my problem isn't alcohol. My problem is something different. It was when I was then, and it was all thereafter. My problem is that I seem to have emotional problems that I don't seem to get a grasp on. For example, much of my life I felt there's something missing in me, and I don't know what it is, but I know at a distance I can get along with people well. When I get close, they don't seem to like me so well. They seem to recognize that there's something missing in me, but nobody ever tells me what it is. The people I want to impress, I feel awkward and clumsy around. The people I don't care about, I get along well, but I don't want to get along with them. Sometimes I feel superior to people, and sometimes I feel inferior to people, but I never feel equal to people. I just always have emotion, always something going on. And I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to try to get to the root of this, and it helped me a lot. I began believing I was a victim, and it wasn't my fault. That kept me going for a while. I read books. I did a lot of things. But I'll tell you, the only thing that's ever helped me in that emotion is when it gets bad enough, I have a couple of drinks. That's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. And drinking fills in those holes in me, boy. And I didn't realize this until after I was sober a while again this time. But what it did for me on that ship in Pearl Harbor is the same thing it did for me the last drink I took. Alcohol is the only thing I know that makes me feel the way men look. And I don't know anything better that does that. And if you're new tonight, I want to tell you something sad. It sounds sad. You'll understand it someday. But alcohol is the best friend I ever had. I never had a better friend than alcohol. Friends come and go. Jobs come and go. Lovers come and go. Cities come and go. But when a few drinks is filled in those holes in you, there's nothing like it wherever you are, and it does it whenever you want it to. And my only problem is I get into trouble sometimes. And so as the book said, I again and again try to find ways to get the feeling without the reaction, without the eventual troublesome. And I didn't stay in AA long because I realized, you know, in the first place, my problem isn't alcohol. It is when I'm drunk, but it isn't the real problem. And I can't return to God because I, unfortunately, over the years, got somewhat worse than I was when I was a kid. And I broke a lot of commandments. In fact, by the time I came to AA, this time I'd broken all 10. And that's, you could say, well, you're grown up, but you don't have to listen to that Lutheran stuff. But I'll tell you, everybody that's raised in a strict church knows the same thing Hitler said. You give me their minds till they're 12, and a little bit of them will have those beliefs as long as they live. And I can say, there's no God. Don't give me that crap. But you wake up in the night sometimes, you know you're going to go to hell. you're going to go to hell, and you don't want to think about that. So I went to work in a different city for a big firm called Tracy Lara. How the hell it was. Anyway, we made big railroad engines, I'll tell you that. And I got in some trouble drinking in that town, and I had an idea. I thought, I'll go to the... AA was not very well known. I went to the human resources people. I said, I have a little drinking problem, but they have this new thing in town called AA, and I'm going to try that. Would you give me a couple weeks to work? And he said, oh, sure. That's a good... I don't know much about it. And so I did that again and again in various companies. And nothing else that gives you a couple weeks to look for a new job. And you can go home and say to your wife, well, I've gone back to AA. Wonderful. I think it'll work this time, honey. I know it will. What do they want you to do? They want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for anybody anywhere. No, you don't taper off at all. They want you to stop entirely. We have the same steps you do. I know how it's supposed to be. I release you, you son of a bitch. But I went up and down and up and down and up and down. And one time I went down and didn't come back up. I couldn't believe it. I always could bounce up in a new city. And I didn't. And on Monday, I was a big executive at Tracy Locke Advertising in Dallas, writing on the L.C. Elmer ads for the board company. On Friday, I was fired. My wife and children had left. They warned her and she got out. They took back my car. I was out of my house, stood in the street corner in Dallas with my bags. Now, how could this happen to me? And I knew I had to get out of Texas because I was kind of hot with the state hospital there. And so a guy gave me a car to drive to Los Angeles, and I drove it and got as far as El Paso the first night and had a wonderful time in Juarez. I used to be on the faculty of the college in El Paso, and I spent a lot of wonderful nights in Juarez. Some of you won't understand this, but yo soy el maestro de los locos in Chihuahua y más tequila y limón y sal. You need that Spanish in the Juarez jail, actually, is where you need it. Hey, I'm an American! I'm an American! Some little guy in a gray suit comes by and says, hey, gringo, silencio. Well, I had a good time that night. The next night I drove as far as Phoenix, got drunk and lost the car. Everything I owned was in it, my ID, my clothes. I got beefed that night in the street corner with a guy, turned out to be a cop, and he threw me in jail overnight. In the middle of the night, so sick, about 130 up in that drunk tank. In the end of August, so sick. And I went over and threw up in the toilet. It turned out to be a guy's bunk, actually, but I thought of the toilet. There was nobody in it, but it made me feel better. And I laid down next to his bunk, and it's cool tile. I thought, oh, boy. And this guy came back. He must have been a trustee or something, wherever he'd been. He found his bunk full of vomit, and here's a drunk man. He says, you dirty girl! And kicked my front teeth out. And that was one morning I was really glad I'd been in psychoanalysis, because I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. Yeah. But I didn't want to say anything. And I came out of there the next morning, hit the streets of Phoenix where I didn't know it was so hotter than hell. When you look that bad, I'd been in and out of A for a lot of years by this time. I'm playing my little games with AA. I'd stay in there till the heat was off. But I knew how AA's acted. So I found the AA club there, looked at the phone books over the Arid Club, not very far away. And I walked over there and hustled some old lady for $20. I told her I needed it for a 12-step house because I wanted the program. And I rushed downtown, got a Greyhound bus ticket, came to Los Angeles. And I had a guy at KFWB who I'd given his start many years before that. And he was a big star now. And I called him up and said, Jesus, Ted, I said, I've had a terrible car accident and lost it. I've gotten bad shape. Could you let me have some money? He said, sure. Told me how to take the bus to KFWB on Hollywood Boulevard. He gave me $100 and some, which then was a lot of money. And I had a great time for a few days. Then I tapped out again. And I called him up and said, gee, Ted, I need a little more money. Check hasn't come yet. He said, no, listen, Clancy, I called Dallas. You You've got any check coming? You're a bum. You're a bum. You're a bum in Dallas. You're a bum now. Don't bother me. I said, Jesus, Ted, don't do this to me. I need something. He said, okay, but don't. I don't want you coming in the station again. I want you. At that time, the station was on Hollywood Boulevard. He said, you come to the back of the station in the alley at 9 o'clock, and I'll come out there and see you. But don't come at the station. So I'm out there 9 o'clock, raining and sick and cold. The guy came out of the wire ship and he threw a $5 bill. Said, you stay away from here, you drunken bastard. And it fluttered down to a puddle of water, and I crawled out and got it. And thought, I guess I outsmarted him. And a couple of days later, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission downtown Los Angeles. And stay out of here, you mooch! I tried to explain, am I not a mooch? 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the L.C. Delmer ads, were running it very weak in Life and Time and the New Yorker and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside of that damn old mission on a cold, rainy morning and sick and my mouth bleeding and feeling so terrible and cold. And I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what it was then, but I know what it is now because I've seen it in others. And I'm sure there are people in this room who've had it. The feeling of suddenly realizing there's no friendly direction. No matter which way you go, no one's glad to see you, pal. You've done it now. And I just stood there. If some old guy came up that morning and said, you know, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You look like a rotten bum. Your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather's so tired of watching you call her and play on her emotions, so she'll go down to her little tiny bank account and take a few more dollars out and send it to her little boy to try to help him. He'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. Now, you've been going to AA for years now and sitting in these meetings and waiting for the heat to go off and laughing and smirking at their little returning to God and all their stuff and their little live and let live and all the baloney. And now you're dying. Why don't you go back to AA? He might have said, why don't you go back to AA one more time and at least admit you're an alcoholic and see what happens? And if some guy had said that to me, I'd have to say the same thing. If I were to be honest, I'd have to tell him the truth. It isn't the way it looks, pal. My problem is not really alcohol. I got a lot of problems inside of me that I couldn't even describe. But my problem is not alcohol, and I'm not an alcoholic. And he might have said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic. I couldn't have done that. I wouldn't have the ability to stand back and delineate the differences. So I would have done what people like me do when we get cornered and we get afraid. And you take defense behind bluster. You say things like, get out of my face, you son of a bitch, I'll crack you, leave me alone! Because I don't want them to get close enough to know that I'm afraid. But nobody came up to that morning. So I just knew I had to get off that street. I was going to die right there. Where do you go? Some crappy AA club. I said, where's the AA club? Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that is. So I said, how do you get there? He said, well, Wilshire doesn't come on this way. You have to go up this hill to Hill Street and cut over to Wilshire, walk west till you get to Fairfax. And I did that. And I still remember that. I counted later in my car, 72 long blocks. That's a long way to go in a strange town where you don't know a soul. And my mouth started bleeding again, and my coat was ripped, and there's vomit on me. And I remember people on Wilshire Boulevard going by in cars and going, look at that hideous mess. I don't know what they said, but I'm sure that's what they said. And I got to this AA club and the same old crap, you know, same old steps. God, turn over to God. Live and let live. Welcome home. Jesus Christ. I thought, why wasn't I born stupid so I could accept this? And I hung around that Dan club. They had a meeting that night and I ate about 4 pounds of cake because I could eat that. And they talked about gratitude and almost puked it up again. Then it was still raining. I had no place to sleep. But I thought, I better do my newcomer bit. So I went to the manager. I said, my name is Clancy. I'm a newcomer. I'm looking for sobriety on an all-time basis. But I have no place to sleep tonight. It's raining. It's cold. Could you help me? He said, yeah, kid, you're in luck. A guy named Joe Quinn from down around Laguna Beach left an old 49 Merc in the parking lot. Summer doesn't run, but you can dry, you can sleep in that. You want me to sleep in an abandoned car? Good deal, huh?
Yeah, thanks.
And I still remember sleeping on a band and kind of thinking, God, how could this happen to me? I really never meant to be bad. I never meant to do bad things. If only I could have found some way to control my feelings somehow. If only I didn't need to escape all the time. And the next day I went in, they had a spiritual meeting on Sunday morning where they talked about God or Jesus, and I didn't want to hear that because of God. I didn't even want God to know where I am. Boom! And the next night there was a meeting, and I went to that and ate some more cake. And this went on for days, several days. I remember thinking, maybe this is what hell is. Maybe it isn't fire and brimstone. Maybe it's being cold and you're sick and your mouth hurts and bleeds and people ridicule you. And every day someone talks to you about AA. Jesus. And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety date. I didn't want it to be. Didn't want to be sober. They say the only requirement for members is the desire to stop drinking. I had no desire. Because I know what stopping drinking does to me. The one time I ever really stopped drinking, and I gave it all I had, I used to go to jail every so often overnight. I'm no big felon or anything, but certain times I get to the right alcohol level and I find it necessary to correct police officers and just tell them they're blue belly, no good shit. And so I spent a lot of nights overnight in jail. And I come out of jail one morning, no big deal, I'm going to go home, take a shower, and go to work. And the guy said, gee, I'm down here to meet you. I've got some bad news for you. While you were out drunk last night, your little son died and we couldn't find you. And I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and he died. And I'll tell you, that just about killed me. And I swore this would never happen again. I remember still sitting on Sunday, sitting in our living room with my wife's father, who was a farmer, and who were two big brothers who were healthy farmers. And they were all so nice to me. Here, Clancy, have some more coffee. Oh, here, have some pastries. But in their eyes, you could see, you dirty bastard, look what you did to our sister. You know, but yeah. And the next day when we went to the funeral, when nobody's looking, I put my hand in my son's casket. I said, John Emslin, this will never happen again. I swear to God, it will never happen again. And then we got along pretty well. Up to then, my problem was, one of the problems I had about being an alcoholic is that, you know, they always say alcoholics can't quit drinking. I can quit anytime. I've quit so many times and various reasons. My problem has never been quitting. My problem is, after I quit, sooner or later, a day or two or three or four days, somebody sneaks into my bedroom and puts an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it comes out as just a little growing restlessness, little irritability, little being tired of being servants from people who are depending on me for their bread and butter, and a company who I'm saving with my writing, and they're giving me these servants all the time, and I'm sick of this, and they don't like this town, this job is barren, and the pressure gets. There's only one way to count it that I ever found quick, and that's to have two or three drinks. That's why I take them. And if I didn't, they hadn't put that spring in my gut, I wouldn't be there, I always thought. This time, there was no spring in my gut, and my kids and I did things like Easter. Somebody died, we're going to be for our blessing. And it was very good. We used to play together, hadn't done that for years. And then after a while, somebody came into my bedroom one night and put a spring in my gut. And the next day, it started again. And now it had even a new dimension that just made me crazy. I began to realize, God, this Norwegian stinking God, had killed my little sinless son to punish me because I'm a bad man. What a terrible thing to do, to kill my little boy who never did a bad thing in his life to get at me. Screw you, God. Don't you never hear that name again. And I quit. But I promised my son I wouldn't quit, but the pressure was on. And pretty soon I didn't like the job so much anymore. And I was getting day after day. And my kids' noise at night. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For Christ's sake, give me. I'm sorry, we'll play tomorrow. And just hate myself for being like this. And it got worse and worse. And if I could just have two or three drinks. But I promised my dead son I wouldn't have two or three drinks. And one day my wife took the kids to Mass. And I just put the car in the garage, hooked up a hose to the exhaust pipe, turned the motor and went to sleep and died. And a guy next door, some freak of luck, happened to be sitting in his kitchen having a cup of coffee, and noticed me go there and heard the motor running, and I didn't come out, so he thought maybe something had happened. So he ambled over, finally found me dead in the car, and pulled me out and beat on my chest and breathed in my mouth. They rushed me to the hospital and determined I was seriously mentally ill and put me to the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas for an indefinite period, from which I escaped and I was brought back and given 3 months of electric shock. That's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. Stopping drinking is no incentive to me. Now, why would I stop drinking this time? Why would I stop drinking this time? And sobriety is a lethal thing. And here's it. I've thought about this many times. But, you know, somebody gave me a tape when I was 3 years sober. I talking, and it again refurbished my memories and things that I've always known about, of course. But at that club, there was a guy who used to come to the meeting who was a movie actor. And I'd seen him in the movies. And I thought, big deal. I found out later he's just a small-time character actor and made three or four. Well, he was big in the radio, but not in movies. I've been in more movies than he was ever in. But I didn't know that. He's a movie actor. And the one thing you know about movie actors, they're rich and famous. Maybe he didn't seem very bright. Maybe I could get next to him and we could share his fame and fortune somehow. And then he started nagging me, time to get a sponsor, get a sponsor. I said, Bob, I've always admired you so much. Could you be my sponsor? I said, sure, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I'll tell you, they said he wasn't a very good actor. He was, because in meetings he acted decently. That took a lot of acting for him. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Do this. I said, why would I take this crap from this guy? Because he was my meal ticket out of there. That's why. And I found out later he didn't like me. And I understand that exactly, because I look back, I don't like to brag, but I was the worst type of newcomer there is in AA. And I know that because I've had a couple like him to sponsor since then. And they are crappy. And I'll tell you who they are. People who've been around AA a long time and know all about it and keep drinking. Because anything you tell them, oh, I know that. I remember telling Bob one time, just made him crazy. I said, he'd explain something in depth to me about the steps. I said, gee, that's very interesting, Bob, but I think you misquoted the book, didn't you? Yeah. It just makes you want to take out a pistol. Boom, boom, you know. But he tried to help me. He really was trying to a good AA, and he tried to help me and talk to me. And he'd take me with him a couple times to meetings where he spoke. Sometimes I heard him saying to somebody, maybe me or maybe somebody else, I don't remember who, but I remember him saying to the effect of, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to keep drinking, you're going to die. What now? What does that mean, Bob? Explain that to me, will you? Come to AA and say your problem is not alcohol? That's right, kid. If your problem is alcohol, you don't need AA. Oh, really, Bob? What do we need? Screen Actors Guild? Is that what we should have? I said, shut up, he explained. I said, no. Now listen to me. And he gave me a long explanation of what the difference. And I don't remember much about it, but I know it seemed impressive to me. But the line that always stuck in my mind was this. If your problem is alcohol, what you do and you have trouble with it, you quit. You clean up your act and quit. However, if you suffer from this other thing that we are suffering from, which sounds like alcohol and fools so many people, it is something called alcoholism. I thought, Jesus, Bob, don't play word games with me. I look trouble, but I'm smart. Alcoholism. He said, listen. If you suffer from alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism, you'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, that happens to me again, Bob. But why would people drink if alcohol is doing such terrible things to them? He says, you don't seem to understand that either, do you, kid? People don't drink because it's doing terrible things to them. That's way down the road. The thing that we have in common is this. It is what alcohol does to us at all. It's something entirely different. It's what alcohol does for us. When I have a few drinks, it almost instantly alters my perception of reality. It almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. It almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less frightening to me. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He says, because it's not real. It's just a fantasy you're having, kid. And then it sets up this thing. Pretty soon you get in this terrible thing of craving that nobody can talk to know what that's about. And that's true. You think about that. No one has ever described what craving, what causes this craving, this abnormal craving. Some years ago, I was thinking about that, explaining to a new guy. And I came up with a concept, at least I believe it's correct for me, maybe for some of you, maybe not. But when I drink to get away from that, to get somewhere, to feel, and I get there, and I almost immediately begin to sag, and you just instinctively have another drink. And you instinctively have another drink. You can watch guys get so drunk they can't even walk, and they're still crying out for another drink, crying out. Why? Because they're trying to hold that. And eventually they get drunk and it all goes anyway. They get sober. But he says to me, he says, you know, kid, you always get sober again. And I said, Jesus, Bob, if that's the case, why don't people just stay sober then go through all that? And he had a philosophy that he hinted at in the book, and I'd forgotten for years till I heard that old tape again, and I remembered it so clearly. He said, look, kid, when human beings are born, when you grow up, you go through a lot of things. Problems, you have to find your way to get through problems and how to deal with conflicts and the things you do, things you like and things you don't like and things that are good for you and things that are bad for you. And you learn to cope with them and work through the problems. And eventually that's called maturing. And eventually you become a mature individual and you live pretty comfortably because you don't get into situations, you don't get into jackpots, you know where they are. You do things that are pleasant for you, you live with a peace with the world. He said, this almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because when people like us are growing up and we get into conflicts and problems we can't solve, we get rid of them by drinking. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. As a result of that, little by little, I get a closet full of unsolved emotional problems. And all of a sudden, here I'm going to stay sober. I wouldn't have guessed this in 10,000 years. Because it seems to me I'm sober. I got a fairly good brain. I've got some abilities. I've got desire to do better. And never once guessing that all of these things are at the beck and call of childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions because it sounds a little bit better. Oh, I guess that's my alcoholism. What are alcoholic emotions? I love you. I hate you. You hurt my feelings. I'm going to run away. Let's get married. And you live in those childish emotions. You get a lot of problems and conflicts, a lot of pain. And eventually you got to have some relief. So you drink. In fact, some doctors say you get to a point sometimes where you literally must drink to preserve your sanity. And you drink till you have to get sober. And you stay sober till you have to drink. And you drink till you have to stay sober. And every time back and forth, your brain says, see, it wasn't really the alcohol at all. It's all these other things they don't understand. Your case truly is different. They don't understand that. And that's kind of funny, except that people like us die from that every day. And I said, Jesus, Bob, that sounds exactly what I've been doing all my adult life. He said, there's a name for people like you. I said, what is it, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I remember thinking, well, I'll be damned. I've just thrown away the best 10 years of my life. I had opportunity after opportunity to really be something, to be all sorts of things, big cities, top-notcher. And instead of living in an abandoned car, I said, Jesus, Bob, why doesn't AA explain these things the way you do? To the allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, all that crap. Why don't they talk about what you talk about? He says, they do, kid. See that first step? It says you have to admit you're having problems with alcohol. Dash, in the English language, that means end of thought, beginning of new thought. You must also admit you're having problems without alcohol. And I said, huh. That was in January, I guess, of 1959, a long time ago. And I never really had a severe desire to drink alcohol since then. You may wonder why. Oh, his life turned out wonderfully. Not at all. My early sobriety was terrible because my whole style was sarcasm and smart-aleck remarks. And people don't like to take that crap from people without front teeth. You know, just something about it loses something. And I get fired off jobs. I was having a terrible time. Why wouldn't I drink? Because I'll tell you why. All those years I sat in AA meetings, hearing these idiots talk about their slips. Oh boy, I had a terrible slip. I lost everything. My brother slipped and he committed suicide. I remember a guy said one time, another guy slipped, backed over his little boy in the driveway. I knew this, having slips make it really bad. And it was so bad for me now I could barely bear it. What would a slip do? So I gave myself the permission to commit suicide if I had to. But I wouldn't drink. And several times in the first couple of years, it got bad enough to drink, but not quite bad enough to commit suicide. And my sponsor, in my pain, I would talk to him a little bit more and a little bit more. I never would have done that before. And something gradually happened. I gradually began to feel that my sponsor knew how I felt. And it doesn't sound like much, but that was the first time that ever happened in my adult life. And it really meant something. I'll tell you why. But not so he'd give me some more advice. We've all had enough advice to last us 10,000 years. But if you find someone who you believe really knows how you feel, that advice becomes meaningful information. And you may take actions you wouldn't take based on anything else. And I did things for my sponsor I wouldn't have done for my father or for my employers or God or nobody. Actually, because I thought he knew how I felt. But of course the problem is this, if you have a strong sponsor, they begin asking you to do stupid things. Stupid, stupid, insulting, mentally deficient things. Now, they don't actually say this. It sounds like this, but they don't say this. See that wall, Clancy? That wall is bright red. No, Bob, you're kidding. That's cream colored. So I tell you, it's bright red. Cream colored. Well, goddammit, you act like it's bright red. He never told me the color of walls. He told me things equally stupid. I want you to apologize to that woman. You called her a bitch. She is a bitch, Bob. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize.
Sorry.
Bitch. I don't care how it looks to you. Don't quit that job. But Jesus, Bob, they got me stuffing envelopes for $1.09 an hour. I used to have an office bigger than this whole company, for Christ's sake. Now, I just... So we stay on that job till you get a better one. I understand you didn't have been going to the Friday night meeting. Well, Bob, it's a big clique. It's just an in-group, and they just all suck around together, and they treat me like a bunch of crap. Well, maybe they're right. Go to that meeting. And that goes on and on and on and on till you're crazy. One day you turn around and the damn wall is red. Then you have to spend the rest of your life dealing with dumbbells who think it's cream-colored. But little by little, I began doing a little better, and I finally got a job I held, crappy job, and then a better one. But that thing I want to say to new people, I know we're running a bit late, and I don't want to hold you. I know many of you have many blocks to go to get home. But they start grinding me about taking the steps. And I told Bob, I said, Bob, you know, I really am trying to do better. I realize I'm an alcoholic, maybe a different kind of alcoholic, but I cannot return to God. I cannot. I wish I could, but there's something there. I cannot return to God. He said, kid, nothing says you have to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob. Does that fool the other boys and girls? I know what you're talking about. I know what you're talking about. She says, it doesn't say that either, for Christ's sake. Read it. Because you came to believe in something, not to we never ask you to return to anything, because you're coming out of sickness. You come to believe in something. Can't you believe in God? And I said, no, I can't, Bob. He says, can't you believe in AA? I said, I like AA kind of now, but it's too religious. I can't do all that. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are. He said, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that. I could accept that. He couldn't send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. But I did things to please him. Now, the nice thing, if you're new, remember this. When they ask you to come to believe there's a power here, you don't have to understand what it's going to do for you. You just have to believe it's there. Because it's going to restore you to sanity. Well, how's he going to do that? Don't have to worry about that. That's down the road. It takes a while to understand that. But the question is, what is sanity? Now, there's a question. You can read 10 textbooks on mental health and you get 10 different definitions of sanity. But oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. Psychosis is easy to define. To oversimplify, kind of. But when the mind is of sufficient conflict that it cannot resolve, and it's just in great danger, it will, to maintain its neural integrity, it will alter the perception of reality. That's called psychosis. I will make things look different than they are. I'll give them different meanings. If you're really bad, it's the whole world, they put you in the nut house. Sometimes it's just rifle, little bounce. These are the people he was a good neighbor for 40 years. All of a sudden he took a gun and started shooting people. Somebody triggered that little part of that personality. That psychosis is a... Now, here's a funny thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic are almost impossible. Would you say? They say this is the second greatest cause of insanity. That's right. But not psychosis. Alcoholic insanity is a different situation. It's a physical condition. I'm sure all of you, when you've come off a drunk, have had the feeling of you need something to put the fire out. You're just, dry out. The reason for that is alcohol may be the only fluid I know of that takes moisture out of your body, kills, dries out cells and kills them. And in the morning or whenever you get around to it, you take cold beverages or warm beverages or any kind of beverages and put it in your body, and the cells revive. There's only two organs in your body in which the cells, when they're dead, they stay dead. One is your brain, one is your liver. And that's why we have problems with those two items. And that's why people die from that. But in the brain, you don't die from it. Your brain, eventually you drink enough. It takes a long time and a hard drink and different amounts for different people. But your brain eventually has enough dead cells so that it's almost dried up. We call it a wet brain, ironically. It's called the Korsakoff syndrome. And you think, well, maybe, I wonder if I got that. If you think you got it, you haven't. I'll tell you, you've never seen it. I'm sure most of you have never seen a case of this. I see them all the time, and they're sickening. People with dried out brains, alcoholic insanity, are sitting on a bed somewhere in a ward, and they come and feed them, and put them, change their diapers, and put them to bed, and get them up, and change their diapers, and feed them, and feed them, and change their diapers, and put them to bed. And this goes on, and they can never get better. If their body is healthy, they can live like that for 40 or 50 years. And sometimes their families come down to see if dad or mom knows them. You know, who are you? Get out of here. So they cry and go home. That's alcoholic insanity. That is bad news, I'll tell you. But psychosis is something different. Why don't alcoholics become psychotic? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they drink alcohol and change their perception of reality. I can literally induce temporary psychosis. 95% of drinkers can't, 90% of drinkers can't, but I can and you can. But I never realized that. I can literally change my perception of reality by drinking alcohol. So I guess what it had to mean in the second step was this. I have to come to believe there's some power here that will enable me to live in reality without having to run away. Sounds difficult, but you don't have to know how it's going to happen. You have to believe it will happen, and if it didn't happen, the rest of us wouldn't be here, I'll tell you, because we all are the same in that area. So all you got to try to do is, no big deal, come to believe there's a power greater than yourself, whatever it might be, your sponsor, AA, God, whatever you like, will eventually enable you to live in the world without having to drink to stand it or take opiates to make you get run away or smoke marijuana cigarettes or whatever it is, without having to run away. And that's the second step. And then the third step, which I read so much into, it's quite simple. For me, it was quite simple at that time. What the third step had to mean was, I've got problems drinking. I got problems sober. There's a power here somewhere that's going to enable me not to have to drink. Maybe my sponsor. And the step three is do what he says. Do what he says. It may get more complex in later years in sobriety, but I'll tell you, when you're struggling, that's what it means. And I did that. And eventually, I was 5 years sober. I'd got a pretty good job as an advertising manager of a medical corporation. I was 7 years sober, and another guy I were brought to Hollywood. We created something called Boss Radio. We became the number one hard rock station in the world. If you ever see it, if you got a computer, look on your for the Boss Radio, and you'll see what I look like when I weighed 50 pounds less. I didn't have front teeth, but I was 10 years sober downtown doing public relations for oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same, my wife and children in Dallas somehow got wind of the green in my wallet. I mean, I'd sent the money, but Christ, they leaped out of their post office box and rushed to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God it was a little boy, or I might have drowned it. What I would do. And thank God somebody got me a book on the rhythm system, and that was the end of that. You know, just now my kids are all grown up. Three of my daughters are turning 16 this year in AA. My son is, and my other daughters are not alcoholic. My son is not an alcoholic. His wife, who's been in Al-Anon for 3 years, thinks he is, but he doesn't. And that's, I wish I could help him. It's an amazing thing. I've sponsored a lot of people over the last 46 years. But you can't help your own son. You can't help your own daughter. You can't help your wife or your husband or your father or mother. It's just because you got to have a relationship where you don't see him emotionally. You see him as AAs. I wish him well. God bless him. Only one of my kids has turned out bad. I hate to talk about that, but I guess you have to do it. My oldest daughter's become a judge. I'd always hope for a defense attorney, but no. She comes home for Christmas. She says, you know, Daddy, when we were little girls, you used to send us to our room. I said, sure, honey. She says, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I have no need to go to Albuquerque. I never left anything there. But anyway. And the only other thing I have to tell you is this. When I was 15 years sober, the wall changed color on me so significantly I couldn't believe it. And one day I found myself leaving a job in Beverly Hills where I was very well paid. And for the last 31 years, I've been the managing director of the Skid Row Mission that threw me out in 1958. And every morning when I get up by the ocean, I drive downtown and watch people die from alcoholism and drug addiction. We're not a treatment center. We're way below that. It's people say, why would you do that? And I cannot think of a good answer. You know, well, with such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it must be spiritual. Or, well, I'm still trying to get those two bastards. Once I get them, I'll be out of here. I don't know why. But I know this. I thought about this many times. When I come home at night, I always feel more like, I feel sometimes impervious to bullets, more than I ever did going down those elevators, popping my fingers and being hip, slick, and cool. Now, if you're new tonight, don't misunderstand me. I'm not telling you that if you stay sober and want to feel good, you have to have a mission. There's only so many go around. I got mine, and but what you have to do is stay around here, and I hope to God you find somebody that knows, that you believe knows how you feel, and you will take actions as I did. One day when I was 6 months sober, I was going to commit suicide. I felt so bad. And my sponsor prevailed upon me to write an inventory instead, something I wasn't going to do. When I was a year sober, my father, he made me make amends to my father, a man that I hated and wanted to see dead. And somehow or other, over a period of time, we got exchanging information, and it wasn't the way it was, I thought it was at all. And we became rather close, closer than most fathers and sons. And he came out and lived with us in California when he was an old guy, going home to die. Went back to Wisconsin like an old elephant to the burial ground, and I was holding his hand. He gave me a little squeeze, and I squeezed him, and he died. You know, talk about the color of the wall, that's as good an example as I know, come to think about it. If you'd come up to me in the old days and said, tell me about your father. I said, my father was a smart man, but he was a rotten son of a bitch. He deserted my mother and I. He left us float. He had no interest in my children. He had no interest in anything. He just was selfish. He had another child and gave her everything I should have had. And he's dead now, and I hope he's in hell. And I hope they're jabbing him with fire sticks and making him feel scream. But if you'd come up to me now and say, tell me about your father, based on AA, what has happened here, I'd have to say, well, my father and I really saw things differently. I thought he was rejecting me. He thought I was rejecting him. He used to go to bed and cry. He felt so bad his only son wouldn't. And I went to go to bed and feel bad because I thought he was against me. But thank God we resolved it. And he's dead now. And I hope he's in Valhalla, Norwegian heaven. And I hope he's saving a seat right next to me, next to for me. I'll be along pretty soon. We can sit and laugh and talk some more. Now, what changed? Nothing changed. Just the color of the wall. Just the color of the wall. That's all that changed. And that's why it's so important. You can't predict how it's going to look. You can't say, I'm not going to do that because that wall isn't going to change color. It sure as hell is, or else you won't be around here. And that's why you got to keep doing these things. I hope you can find somebody. As eventually I came to believe in AA as my higher power. Much to my surprise, sometime later I found myself praying to God when I realized I wasn't important enough for God to hate. And I've come to believe God loves me. I've come to believe God loves me the same as he loves you and the same as he loves everybody. And the reason some people around here seem to do better than others, because once in a while they do things that rip open their head and get a little God's grace filters in between their self-obsessions. That's all. So I'm glad. You know, you've had a wonderful day here today. I looked at the program about the steps and the traditions and the program and sponsorship, those important things. I would think that sponsorship ranks among in my life always such a high thing, because without that I never would have done any of the actions that made me feel better. But put together, they make a program of recovery. If you're new, you cannot predict what's going to happen. All you can do is believe that we didn't all come here to lie to you, pal. We are here because it's worked for us and it'll work for you. You know, I've been sober a long time. And I've been active all this time, so I've had a chance to do some things most of you have never done. I've been asked to come and speak in exotic places like Cape Town, South Africa, and Berlin, and London, and Paris, and Spain. And last weekend I was in Copenhagen, Denmark, and the next few weeks I'll be in Australia. You think, oh, AA is exotic in all these places. Not at all, except for the accents. You hear exactly the same feelings, same emotions, same doubts, same fears, same reassurances. Same people saying, I know how you feel. And you want to stay here and take advantage of that, because you are not different anymore. Thank you.